Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study.
I'm very happy to have on the programme today Maxine Anastasi, who is a postgraduate student who's working here at the university. A few words about Maxine. She graduated with a BA on honours degree in archaeology in 2007 and registered for a research master's degree in Roman archaeology under the supervision of Professor Anthony Bonanno here at the university. Her research involves the contextual study of late Punic and Roman period pottery in the Maltese Islands. And she's involved in several research projects, all of which involve also the Department of Classics and Archaeology at the University of Malta. Her work includes post-excavation analysis related to the publication of the final report of the department's excavations at Tas Silj, and assisting the ceramic specialists on the Ar Ishir Gozo excavation project, and also the Zaytun Villa excavation project and the Malta survey project. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Tricia, for inviting me to speak this morning.
Pleasure. Archaeology, of course, is a subject very close to my heart, so having you on the programme is a real pleasure, and I look forward to talking about the subject of pottery and eventually specifically Maltese pottery, because of course it's such a key element in archaeological studies. Let's start off by examining a little bit the topic of your research. What exactly are you doing?
I'm focusing on late Punic and Roman period pottery, mostly local, that is actually found on the islands. And this is roughly dated to between the 4th century BC for the late Punic rite to the 5th century AD, really, for the beginning of the end of the Roman period. And what I'm trying to do is go over pottery that comes from a series of different contexts, so different sites and what they were used for. And that's basically funerary, so from tombs, a ritual context from the Tas Silj sanctuary, and also I'm looking at domestic, where we have the Zaytun Villa excavation. And my hope is to look at all this pottery and compare it to see whether its actual function is similar or different between these different contexts. Trying to get away from the predefined ideas that we always have about a jug is just for pouring water or an amphora is just for transporting commodities.
You're trying to think laterally about
it. Yeah, I'm trying to analyse the purpose of vessels in more detail, because there are actually so many varieties that...
Well, I hope we'll go into a bit more into the detail about those, because I've done a little bit of work on the Punic pottery and a bit on the Roman, especially the lamps, of course, which come from the catacombs. Perhaps we also ought to look at why pottery is so important within the archaeological context. Why study pottery, really, at the end of the day?
Well, in a sense, like anything else, I believe that everything deserves study, especially in archaeology, where we are faced with artifacts which we don't have the people to tell us what they are all about. And pottery also is one of the most common finds on a site. We're very lucky that in practically every excavation conducted, thousands and thousands of potsherds come up. So you're more likely to be able to gather data from pottery than you are from the few coins that tend to be excavated or a few artworks. And also, in antiquity, pottery did tend to be one of the most common productions. It's very cheap to manufacture pottery, and also it's very fragile, so it breaks easily and would have had to be thrown away and bought again. Plus, in an archaeological sense, fired clay is very durable, so we are lucky that it survives in a relatively good state to be picked up by archaeologists in comparison to wood or glass, which tends to either disintegrate or fragment beyond you can't recognize it anymore.
What about the different types of pottery? Before you were talking about the fact that you're looking at it perhaps in a bit of a new way, but when you look through books of archaeology, what you look at is what you see very often is classifications, typologies, these lovely drawings where you see half the real thing and then sort of the invented bit on the other side. What are those? Why are those created?
Those are created to have your research tool more manageable. Unfortunately, we're not terribly lucky in finding complete pots most of the time. We tend to find parts of these pots once they've been broken up. So the drawings, for instance, special conventions have been formulated to be able to reconstruct at least part of a pot. And if you end up with a whole profile, which includes your rims, possibly a handle and a base, you almost have a complete vessel once it's drawn up. And by classifying a method which is very similar to, for instance, classifying organisms and used in biology a lot, you're able to
visualize, perhaps, or
yeah, to visualize, and you're also able to. You end up with such vast amounts of different pottery that to look at each individual piece and study and record each individual piece would cause, I mean, it will be a lifetime of work, especially from some excavations where you get tons and tons of pottery. So by looking at everything and finding out key elements which are similar, you can create groups. So you have plates in one group and jugs in another group and bowls or jars. And this allows you to systematically narrow down all that pottery into certain groups, and it's easier to study from there.
So you can tell what something is, and possibly even where it might have come from.
Yes. I mean,
if you're studying a Roman site in Turkey or a Roman site in Spain, you can look at the book of words.
Yes. One of the most important things in archaeology and especially pottery studies is published data. You need to have your material published eventually so you can research particular types or shapes of vessels, especially if they're imported to the island, and you find parallels and comparisons in order to either date your site or find out where these vessels originated from, and then you can eventually track out trade routes, patterns, the economy of especially the Roman Empire. I mean, a lot of work has been done on the trade, where people stopped off, what they were shipping out, what they were exporting, importing, even what they carried to a certain extent. So a tremendous amount of information can come out from just a few.
In fact, the other day there was I had on the program Timmy Gambin, who had given a lecture to the Archaeological Society, which I know that you attended as well, where he was describing this wreck site that he'd found. And the amphora can tell such an incredible story about the ship that went down, really.
Also durability. I mean, you have to be very lucky to find mostly the remains of a shipwreck, but if you've got a cargo packed with amphora, you'd be very lucky if they were sealed also. Your shipwreck is still visible because the pottery, the ceramic itself, tends not to disintegrate in under the seabed. So your shipwrecks are
extremely
crucial.
Important. Yes, that
they're
was a really lucky break.
Yes.
Really, we wouldn't find you wouldn't, in the normal excavation, you wouldn't have perhaps find so much. But when you've classified and when you've created your typology, where do you move from there?
Well, you can either tend to just leave it as a classification, as long as your data has been structured, So you've moved on from having tons of potsherds and now it's in nice groups, defined, drawn, recorded, especially what we call the fabric of a pot, which is the fired clay itself, certain minerals and bits of stone called inclusions within this fabric can again lead on to several other research topics on finding out the minerals within these clays, so you can actually locate their origin. You can say the geography of Malta contains these particular types of minerals, and you can actually pinpoint from region to region. So that's also a very important characteristic to include in your typologies or classifications.
And also, talking about the actual makeup of the clay, even that can tell you, I mean, that creates, as you say, a completely new narrative about who might have made it, or how it was made, where it was made. Sometimes it even has minerals, as you said, and others.
Even residues.
Hay and
there's all sorts of things you can find. And I think every new assemblage has a new feature in it, which it's very exciting to find.
And what about the idea of putting together the pot? Because that was something that had really struck me. I remember when we had lectures with Professor Anthony Fred on pottery, and he was looking at the early pottery before wheel pottery, where you've got these pots which were literally put together in rings and things.
Yes.
Perhaps you could talk a little bit about the difference between a pot that's made by hand and a pot that's made on a wheel.
There are several differences. I mean, really, you don't have a turning wheel, which nowadays baking pottery tends to be, I suppose, a little bit more simplified, or because you've got a spinning wheel, and through the centrifugal forces, you can mould it without having to do the walls manually.
Build it up.
And build it up through either, I think, the slab technique and the coil methods. With a wheel-made vessel, you tend to have thinner walls, and it's, I suppose, a more refined pot, more symmetrical. Handmade tend to be a lot, have thicker walls and uneven walls. And those are some of the key features that you can actually recognise.
And wheel-turned pottery, I mean, was there a moment in time, a sort of eureka moment, when the turning pottery wheel was invented?
Well, that's actually getting, I suppose, new evidence every day suggests that it's being pushed back earlier. For Malta, we always thought that the technology behind the wheel arrived with the Phoenicians sometime the mid-8th century BC. However, actually quite recently we had a Sicilian scholar who's studying Maltese and Sicilian Bronze Age pottery, and he found that the wheel was already probably actually in use during the Bronze Age, so the Borgia Nadur phase, and that would about 2,500 BC.
That's an interesting thought, because as you say, one always associates it with about sort of the Phoenicians, really.
So that was very exciting, because it changes a lot our perception of when these technologies arrived.
And just how sophisticated their technologies were, really, actually. But turning back to your particular research project, I know that you're involved in various, but your actual master's project, what would you say were the key elements of your study?
Well, firstly, I had to learn about pottery. I started out knowing very little, especially about the Roman period, so that in itself was both very interesting and an adventure in itself. Contains a lot of hands-on work, and you have to look at a lot of pottery before you're able to make sense of it. And from something quite dull, it tends to become very exciting.
Did you actually try to make some yourself?
I used to when I was a lot younger. My mother used to own a pottery wheel, and I used to try and make. I was never very successful, but
but there's something very visceral,
yeah,
about making a pot, whether it's a slab pot or a pot on the wheel. When you have actually experienced that idea of creating a pot under your hands, it was something that then made me understand how people must have thought it rather magical.
Yes.
A real magical thing that, okay, they were making a very mundane object, a cooking pot or whatever, but there is something magical about creating a pot, something amazingly emotive about it.
It must be. I mean, clay's a fantastic medium because you start off with a lump of sort of mushy clay and you can create almost anything you'd like. I mean, and clay's not only limited to just pottery vessels. I mean, you can have figurines and bricks and tiles and loom weights we find a lot made of clay. So there's all sorts of objects that can be created from it.
And it was actually so much part of the lives of the people at the time. It must have been a really important moment to find an area where they could actually get the basic ingredients for a pot.
Exactly, and that's why I feel that it's such an important artifact to study, because it's one of the few, I believe, that were actually handled by the people and by almost everyone, because it was so affordable. Very sensitive to fashion changes. I mean, we can notice that every few months there's a new type of dinner set in a shop. And I mean, it would have been the same in that sense.
Tell us about that, about the change in fashion in that period, the early period that you're actually studying.
Well, really, for what I've seen is from the late Punic and you start into the Roman period, there has to be a comparison, I suppose, made between the very utilitarian type of pottery, which can generally remain the same because it's built or it was made for a particular purpose, that there's no modifications need to be made to it. However, for instance, during the Roman period especially, you start having a lot of standardized production.
Mass production.
A lot of mold-made pottery. So you end up with very, very standard shapes, which are just distributed everywhere. I mean, some Roman, mostly made in North Africa, for instance, the African red slip wares, can be found in some parts of India. So they travelled extensively, and they are just in such large numbers. But before that, you had black slipped pottery, they borrowed that concept from the Greeks. And I know you can just trace all these changes. Maybe they'd like the rim shape changes, or they decide to use stamps. And some vessels, particularly in the Roman period, if they've been stamped with the potter's marks, for instance, can be dated to quite accurate figures because of these subtle changes in the pot.
An actual name sometimes.
Yes, especially the Terra Sigillata productions in Italy. Again, it's thanks to the very detailed studies and the typologies that are available for all this material. So you can find a piece of Terra Sigillata at a Silch and look at all the publications, and you can almost date it to within a few decades. I mean, we can be
amazing.
It's
and even the Punic pottery, even the fairly basic Punic pottery, I don't know, jugs, water jugs or something, you get different colours.
Yes.
Don't you?
One of the big sort of technical applications usually used on pottery is the application of slips. And we see from the mid-Punic period onwards that you've got a very thick, waxy, creamy slip. Towards the later period, that starts to degenerate, or they decide they don't need such a waxy slip anymore. So you can almost trace these changes. With the Punic period, I don't think it's as specific as certain products in the Roman period. But we're lucky that recently a lot of work has been dedicated to studying the Punic pottery especially. So hopefully in the future we'll be able to date or even understand technological differences and trace these fashion trends more accurately. And
what about the production itself? I mean, you've got the typical, I can imagine the typical Punic pinched lamps, yeah. And those do start to change, obviously, then to, after the Romans came to Malta. What other items are there within there must be, what do they call it? A sort of, it's like a range that you would normally find. What are the things that you actually have in front of you to look at?
Well, we get a lot of lamps. Jugs, especially those trefoils, so they tend to sort of borrow the technique used to pinch lamp rims. So a lamp, for instance, starts off as a plain saucer, and whilst it's still wet, they pinch two spouts into the rim. The same process is used for trefoil mouth jugs to create a spout, probably to assist pouring without dripping. Then there are several versions of plates and bowls and jars. And then we tend to have specific types found in the tombs, for instance.
And would these have been created here in Malta? Did they have the resources here to do that? Or would they have brought something from abroad?
I believe, and a lot of others have put a lot of study into such a question, and the consensus is that a lot of them were locally produced. I mean, we've got natural clay, the blue clay. Also, certain pots which we found, for instance, at Tasilch, the sanctuary at Tasilch, have a lot of inscribed dedications written on them, and those were inscribed before they were fired. And the actual dedication is in Punic letters to the deity that was worshipped or was probably worshipped at the sanctuary. So something like that, you'd question whether that inscribed pot was made, I don't know, in Africa, inscribed to the goddess, worshipped in Malta and then shipped over. So that doesn't make much sense, or it wouldn't have been very feasible.
But possibly a chemical analysis would be able to settle that issue or not?
No, I think it would, although the Maltese geology shares very similar traits to the southeast of Sicily and also parts of North Africa. So unless we have something very specific in our geology, we might not be
sure. It was very impressive to see one of the trenches in the south side of Tasilch when the university was excavating there, which was a dump for these little dishes. And from the cross section of the trench, you could just see them piled one after the other. It was an amazing sight. So definitely it must have been something very, very common. You went, you took your little plate, you put your offering, and then it got chucked out, really.
And that's another reason why we think they're local, because there are just so many of them. Like you said, that some of the deposits there, when we're talking quite a large spread, thousands were just thrown in. You've got layers which are just a foot thick of just pottery and bone and ash.
Amazing phenomenon. But there are some other, apart from the lamps, there are some other incredible pottery items of the period, statuettes and other things. Pots decorated with the head of Bess, for example.
Those are fascinating.
So there, we've got some, not only the basics, but we've got a lot of artistic work as well.
Yes. The best example would be the Greek attic vases. I mean, those are functional objects, yet the technology and the artistry of the paintings on them can be quite astounding. Superb. And they can tell us just so much more with such decoration on them, all about Greek mythology and even also how vessels were used, because you see so many depictions of people drinking out of the cups that they're painted on.
That's great. Well, I could go on for hours talking about pottery, but unfortunately our time is up. Maxine Anastasi, thank you very, very much for coming on Research Matters today to talk to us.
Thank you for having me.
I do hope you can join us again next week for another edition of Research Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.